Star.
I want to be a fireman.
I want to be a baseball player.
I'll be a chef.
Cause it's like the coolest job ever.
You get to ride around in a giant bus because chefs get to cook yummy cheeseburgers, pizza, and chocolate, everything.
I would be the pitcher because they get to do something all the time. They get right on those trucks and never have to stop for red lights or nothing.
And you get to play really loud.
If your child is sick over and over again, it could be PI, a defect in the immune system that affects millions. Early detection can give children a chance to dream.
Visit us at info4pi.org or call 1-866-INFO-4-PI.
My plan is to be the youngest pitcher to ever throw a no-hitter.
All right, a cookbook that's just for kids.
I know I'm going to be famous because my mom and dad call me the little star.
And that pole you slide down? Cool.
Jeffrey Modell Foundation. 25 years of helping children reach for their dreams.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
Metro Detroit is going down every single Monday night, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. That's the Zone, right? Radio with a Richardson, D.C., only here at 89.3. The station right making waves across the Great Lakes, WHFR.FM. That's right, Detroit's longest running hip-hop show, the Zone Radio with a Richardson, D.C.
Well, he moved early. That's going to draw the yellow flag.
Offsides, number 72, 5 yards.
Check out this fan leaving the game. He's headed straight up the middle and right into a sobriety checkpoint. Let's see how he handles it.
No, officer, I haven't been drinking. I'm the designated driver.
Upon further review, this fan made the right call by being a designated driver.
Sign up to be the designated driver at the stadium and always buckle up. Provided as a public service by the station and Team Coalition.
Performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
Robots the size of blood cells, Earth-like planets outside the solar system.
Science fiction?
No, science faction. Join us, Seth Shostak and
Molly Bentley and
WHFR, each Tuesday at noon for Big Picture Science.
Big Picture Science steps back to get the wide-angle view on science and technology from where they've been to where they're headed.
So think big. Big Picture Science. You'll find it here on WHFR.FM every Tuesday at noon.
We're making waves on WHFR 89.3.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Looking back, looking forward. This week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Extended visits with all our regulars as we say goodbye to 2012 and hello to, you know, the one that comes next. We'll also hear from Casey Dreyer about the outlook for support of planetary science by NASA. There is much to celebrate. Hundreds of newly discovered planets dot our galaxy, and some of them may be much like our own. MESSENGER revealed Mercury as Dawn pulled the veil from asteroid Vesta. Astronomers pushed our knowledge of the cosmos even closer to its beginning, and Curiosity began to uncover more of the red planet's secrets. Much closer to home, a commercial company, SpaceX, flew cargoes to and from low Earth orbit for the first time. Chinese taikonauts flew another mission while space travelers of other nations visited the International Space Station. So much more happened than we have time to talk about, though our shows from throughout the year, along with the blog entries from Emily Lakdawalla and others, provide a surprisingly good record. They're all available at planetary.org. The first of our conversations today is with the Chief Executive Officer of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Bill, I'm glad to use you as the leadoff hitter in this little retrospective, looking back at 2012, but maybe more important, looking forward to 2013 and getting, you know, the big picture.
The big picture.
The CEO view.
Yes. Well, the big picture is we want to foster a community of people who support space exploration. People around the world think space exploration is fantastic. Everybody is so very excited about our recent landing on Mars. Everybody, when they stop and think about it, would like to find out whether or not there's life on the oceans of other worlds like Europa and Enceladus, moons of Jupiter and Saturn in our solar system. To that end, I cannot help but think back on when the Planetary Society was formed in the winter of 1979-1980. These guys were very concerned about the situation in which the public support of space exploration was very high, whereas government funding for it was waning.
Dwindling.
Well said. And so we're at the same crossroads right now. So you put a rover on Mars, now what? Well, now we're going to explore and maybe find something that will change the course of human history. We have to support that. And one of the things the Planetary Society does is advocacy. I've been to Capitol Hill a few times this year. We had a lunch and learn for staffers and congressmen, congresspeople, where we talked about the importance of space exploration and how it brings out the best in us. These extraordinary missions to other worlds are so demanding that we, humankind, comes up with things. We wouldn't have the internet. We wouldn't have smartphones. We wouldn't be able to feed 7 billion people on a planet that once fed barely a billion people, because we have global positioning, we have extraordinary weather forecasting, we have knowledge of our place in space, how the Earth is but one planet among many, many, perhaps billions of planets. And so that's exciting, and you'll hear from Casey Dreyer, our political advocate, about that. And then since the beginning of the Planetary Society, we have done projects. This year, we tried to send very carefully chosen microbes to a very carefully chosen destination, Phobos, the moon of Mars. But we were out there, it crashed in the ocean, but we were out there trying. Space is very difficult. We monitor near-Earth objects, asteroids that could change the course of everything
could
in
end.
A beat, in the way that apparently the ancient dinosaurs had their day ruined. We support that because we have people around the world who just think it's cool, who just think it's exciting, and they want to be part of it. And the other thing that we do is educate people in a unique way about this extraordinary business of exploring space. And you'll hear from Dr. Bruce Betts about the projects, and you'll hear from Emily Lakdawalla, a planetary geologist who works with us, for us, part of the staff, about the exciting missions and the details of them that will, I hope, inspire you. I hope give you something to think about how wonderful this business is that we are all in. So it's an exciting year, Matt. The discoveries that are going to be made on Mars, you just can't predict, but they're going to be amazing. The discoveries made on the missions to asteroids are going to be amazing. The mission MESSENGER at Mercury is going to be amazing. And keep in mind, the next few years, we got a mission going to Juno, and we got a mission going to Pluto. And we got to keep those missions going. We have to keep that process, that pipeline flowing, so that we continue to bring out the best in humankind. We continue to educate people around the world about our place in space and what an extraordinary thing it is to be made of star stuff living in the cosmos. It's an exciting time.
Thanks, Bill. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Glad the world didn't end.
Yeah.
Didn't expect it to, but I'm glad it did.
Up next is Emily Lakdawalla, the senior editor and planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society. Emily, happiest of New Year's. Thank you for joining us from the road. I know that rather than looking back at 2012, you have a lot to look forward to in 2013. You think we all have a lot to look forward to.
Absolutely. There are three missions launching and one returning to Earth in the coming year, so it's going to be an exciting year.
I love this. In the note that you sent me, you said it's Laddie, Maven, and Mom, which sounds like a warm family comedy for the holidays.
It really does, and I do kind of wish that that people would come back to some more traditional-sounding mission names like Voyager and Pioneer and even Magellan and Cassini. They're all great one-word names. These are getting a little odd with the acronyms, but still, they're all great missions. They are going to be missions that are a little bit tougher to explain to the public than, say, a Mars geology rover. LADEE is going to be studying the dust and atmosphere of the moon. Yes, it does have an atmosphere. There's almost nothing there, but it's worth studying. MAVEN will be studying the uppermost atmosphere of Mars, which again is something that's rather important and hasn't really been covered before. Nozomi was supposed to do that, but Nozomi didn't make it into orbit. The Indian Mars mission is really probably just a first of its kind thing for the Indians, and I actually don't know what the instrument component is going to be for that one yet. So they're three rather small missions with fairly tightly constrained science missions, but still, it's always great to see a rocket go up. And these are going to be kind of interesting launches, especially LADEE, which is going to be on the maiden flight of the Minotaur 5, which is the latest in Orbital Science Corporation's rocket family derived from the Peacekeeper intercontinental ballistic missile.
And I'm excited about MAVEN, this dip into the Martian atmosphere. And is there a relationship between this mission and the science that is being done by Curiosity?
Only insofar as the fact that MAVEN will at least bring the capability of relay from a ground mission to Earth, which, of course, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has, and Mars Odyssey is the one doing most of Curiosity's relay, but Odyssey is really not expected to last a whole lot longer, certainly not to be relied upon. And so only having one Mars Orbiter in place for relay is really kind of a scary situation when you're talking about a mission as big as Curiosity and also as the 2020 rover they're now discussing. So we need more assets up there.
Speaking of Curiosity, are you expecting great things from that mission over this new year?
I'm expecting that mission really to get underway in this coming year. Up to this point, they've really just been testing out the instruments, and they really have yet to begin their science mission. They're going to begin it in earnest, and they're also likely to begin their great road trip this year. And probably it will be toward the end of the year that hopefully we'll be reaching the foothills of that gigantic mountain that's waiting for us in the middle of Gale Crater.
Mount Sharp. Anything else we should be looking toward around the solar system?
Absolutely. I think the other big thing to keep in mind is that Juno, which is a Jupiter orbiter, is going to be coming back to Earth in October for an Earth flyby. It needs a gravity assist to send it on to its three-more-year cruise to get to Jupiter in July 2016. And that one has a camera on it that is specifically designed to take pretty pictures. It's on there for no other reason. And so I'm really looking forward to the Earth photos that this Jupiter orbiter is going to take as it flies past.
Okay, before we say goodbye for this week, I just wonder if you have anything you'd like to add about Cassini, because as you know, that's a favorite of mine. We're overdue for talking about that mission again.
Well, Cassini is going to be spending the coming year in a very high polar orbit looking down upon the rings, which means, you know, I'm a huge fan of geology, so I don't get to see as many pictures of my beloved icy moons, but we are going to be getting great photos of Saturn's rings throughout the year. So it's really something to look forward to there.
And we'll get Linda Spilker, the principal investigator for that mission, back on the show very soon. Emily, you'll be back next week. So thank you and enjoy that vacation that you're on and have a great new year.
Thanks. You too, Matt.
She is the senior editor for the Planetary Society and a planetary evangelist for us, for everybody really, and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. That's my colleague, Emily Lakdawalla. There's more ahead. We'll visit with the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer right after the break and get a year-end project review from Bruce Betts as Planetary Radio continues.
Hey, Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society, speaking to you from Planet Fest 2012, the celebration of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landing on the surface of Mars. This is taking us our next steps in following the water in the search for life to understand those two deep questions. Where did we come from? And are we alone? This is the most exciting thing that people do. And together, we can advocate for planetary science and, dare I say it, change the world.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We'll hear from Bruce Betts in a few minutes, but first, we have a report from someone who is making his debut appearance on our show. Bill Nye told us up front that rallying support for space exploration was one of the reasons Carl Sagan, Bruce Murray, and Lou Friedman started the Planetary Society more than three decades ago. Advocacy, especially in Washington, D.C., remains a key part of the organization's mission. It is now largely in the capable hands of the newest addition to the staff. Casey Dreyer is the Society's advocacy and outreach strategist. He sat down with me last week to talk about the challenges faced by everyone who wants to see great missions of exploration continue.
Casey, I'm not sure that the story is as happy a one in the area of advocacy as it has been in just accomplishments in space over 2012.
Yeah, 2012 was a really rough year for planetary science. Back in February, the president released a proposed budget, which included this disproportionate cut, about 20%, or about $300 million, to the Planetary Sciences Division of NASA. That's the part of NASA that does Voyager, that does Curiosity, all Mars exploration, all planetary exploration, just got slashed by 20%.
What's the current status at the end of the year? Are we kind of on hold right now, in a sense?
That's exactly where we are. The Congress, back in the spring, restored some of the funding. Different amounts in different houses, but some of the funding came back. But then Congress never reconciled those two bills and never passed a budget for 2013. So we are in something called a continuing resolution, which funds all the federal government at 2012 levels. However, NASA's not allowed to spend beyond what was proposed in 2013. So the cut effectively went into effect October 1st.
We're beginning the new year. What is the Planetary Society, and not just the Planetary Society, but a lot of other advocacy groups that are interested in planetary exploration, what do we want to see happen?
Well, the big thing that we're fighting for Planetary Society with our partners at the AGU and the Vision for Planetary Science and the AAAS is a restoration to the 2012.
We should say American Astronomical Society.
The American Astronomical Society, correct. We're advocating for a return to 2012 levels, and we've done the numbers on this. If you return to 2012 levels, which is $1.5 billion a year, you can do a big Martian sample return mission. You can send a mission to Europa, and you can start doing these smaller, faster, they're called Discovery Class missions, every 36 months. You can do a lot more science with that. You can keep a lot of the scientists and students employed and making great things and doing great discoveries.
I'm pulling for that Europa mission, of course. But how about this rover, which NASA kind of threw out at the end of the year at the AGU, the American Geophysical Union Conference? Sounds pretty good on the face of it.
It is. And again, everyone was totally surprised by this. No one expected NASA to announce this new rover a few weeks ago. So what it is that they're saying in 2020, we do a copy of Curiosity, basically, and we send it to Mars. We have yet to determine what the science goals of this mission are going to be and what exactly it's going to be looking for. So in the first months of next year, there's going to be a science definition team that'll come together and decide what the goals are. The big thing that we feel that it really has to have is what's called a sample cache, or a little place, a bucket, to put pieces of Mars to be retrieved by another robot and sent back to Earth. That's the big goal, and that's what it really has to do to keep moving forward Mars science.
So I get the feeling that you and probably other people are going to be racking up the frequent flyer miles between here and Washington.
Yeah, absolutely. Next year, we have two budget bills that will be passed, 2013 and 2014, hopefully. the whole sequester thing and getting this money back for planetary science is such a high priority that people like me, Bill Nye, and other employees from the Planetary Society will have a very big and consistent presence in Washington, D.C. next year.
Let's finish very quickly with just one piece of good news that came out of the government, and that's it's of a radioactive nature.
Yes. So plutonium-238, which powers deep space probes out to beyond the solar, beyond the asteroid belt, they started to make this stuff again. And they hadn't made this stuff for about 20 years. And we had been using stuff that we had made years ago, plus plutonium we had purchased from the Russians. So that's what powers Curiosity, for example. But that's what we need to go to places like Jupiter, places like Europa, places like Saturn, where the solar power is just too weak. So for the first time in 20 years, they irradiated the first few hundred grams of plutonium, which is the first step in showing that we can do this again. So this was a kind of a dark horse, but incredibly important policy issue that had been left alone for way too long. So that was a very bright spot in 2012.
Are people going to be able to follow your, our, everybody's progress on the website?
Funny you ask that. Yes, they can. planetary.org/SOS is the main homepage for all of our advocacy efforts. I encourage everyone to go there and follow along. We'll be asking and requiring a lot of people's help in contacting their representatives next year to make sure that funding comes back for planetary science.
Thank you, Casey.
Happy to be here.
Casey Dreyer is the Planetary Society's advocacy and outreach strategist. Last, but certainly not least.
Of course not least.
Is Bruce Betts. He is the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. Now, we're going to get to the regular What's Up content here, but we wanted Bruce to give us a little review of the projects that he takes care of, that he coordinates, manages on behalf of the Planetary Society. So, welcome. Where would you like to start?
Why don't we start with a project that's ending because of its success, which is Pioneer Anomaly, looking at the strange, what were thought to be strange accelerations of the Pioneer spacecraft that were observed and caused all sorts of people to come up with all sorts of theories. But with more data that was recovered, thanks to Planetary Society members, they were able to do a more thorough analysis and do some thermal modeling using some other spacecraft data that was recovered. And basically, you can explain it, perhaps not surprisingly, through mundane explanation, primarily through heat that got radiated primarily in the forward direction, so slowed the spacecraft by that little tiny bit.
Good science, maybe not quite as exciting as it some people might have hoped, but certainly not surprising.
I'm excited that it's good science.
Yes, me too. What's next?
Projects in planetary defense, near-Earth asteroid studies and the like. We've continued to have lots of our Shoemaker NEO grant winners tracking and discovering near-Earth asteroids, particularly doing the tracking, but it's the discoveries that get noticed, and I'll mention one of them, 2012 DA14, discovered by one of our winning groups in Spain, and that will be flying about the distance of geostationary satellites flying by the Earth on February 15th of 2013, something to look for in the new year.
Wow. And then I know you also want to talk about this other project where once we find one of these rocks that's not going to miss us, might be one of the ways we would make sure it misses us anyway.
Right. We're trying to look into another possibly very effective way to nudge these asteroids and move them. And the cool part is it involves zapping rocks with lasers. This is what the Scottish researchers that are doing it have dubbed laser bees, because it would be a swarm of spacecraft doing it. But the first steps are to zap rocks in the laboratory, which is, of course, fun, and tells them how practical this is, how effective it is, and how much thrust and momentum you generate, and how nasty it is for your optics to do it. So we're still very active research going on with that. By the way, I should say, before I forget, you can find more information on all of these projects at planetary.org.
One of those projects you can learn more about is one that I think we basically have our thumb out waiting for a ride.
Exactly. So big milestone with LightSail, our attempt to fly solar sail spacecraft, CubeSat spacecraft. Spacecraft construction has been completed. There's still more testing that will be done when we pull them out of storage, but we're looking for a launch, thumb and a ride to try to get to an appropriate orbit to do that. life in the universe, and is there intelligent life out there? We have not discovered aliens, but we're still looking. And optical SETI telescope, the Planetary Society's Optical SETI telescope, run by Harvard University and Paul Horowitz and his group there, has a major electronics upgrade that they've put on in the last very few months that will allow them to much more efficiently sift out false signals, so false aliens, and get rid of those because of their super impressive back-end electronics.
The last of these, looking for that planet that ET might be living on.
Exactly. We've been sponsored various exoplanet research studies over the years. And in recent years, we've particularly been working with Deborah Fisher at Yale University. And so they're continuing to do hardware development, including at Keck Observatory in Hawaii. But also this year, we started working with them on their Alpha Centauri search. So nearest star system to us, looking for planets, utilizing upgrades, fiber optic upgrades to their system, facilitated by Planetary Society. And of course, there was a discovery by a Swiss group of the first planet around Alpha Centauri, in this case, Alpha Centauri B. It's a multi-star system. Now, that was a hellhole with a little over a three-day orbit around its parent star, but it's a good sign because the statistics so far have shown if you find some rocky planets, you'll probably find more. So they're continuing that search, and we look forward to what they find. As they continue to find with their other searches, lots of Neptune, Jupiter type sized objects as well.
You know what I love most about these last two that you've mentioned? That we may have the people at Yale find the world and then the people at Harvard help us talk to them.
Aliens bringing the world together.
From Harvard and Yale. Oh, my.
I want to mention one other thing, Matt, that you were heavily involved with and all of us were, which is PlanetFest.
Great
and
party.
Maybe I've mentioned that, but it was 2 days of fun festivity and lots of great speakers and excitement with 2,000 to 3,000 people hanging out together watching the Mars landing. And we actually arranged for it to work.
I guess we
didn't, but we thought good thoughts.
We provided moral support, and you 2,000 to 3,000 there with us at the Pasadena Convention Center, and many, many more watching remotely around the world, watching
yes,
our
yes,
webcast.
Yes, sorry.
Watching you on stage much of the time, acting as the MC.
Fun. All right, we move on to our more normal, regular, well, I don't know if it's normal, but our regular segment of What's Up. Jupiter, of course, still a bright, starry object dominating in the evening. Just look up there in the east, look up high in the early evening, you'll see bright Jupiter. It's near a reddish star, which is Aldebaran. And we've got a meteor shower coming up, as we mentioned last week, the Quantrontids meteor shower, an above-average shower, maybe 40 meteors per hour at their peak. Usually, it should peak around January 3rd or 4th. So if you're picking this up early after it goes out there, you'll still be able to check it out. But their meteors increase meteor activity a couple days before and a couple days after. There is some last quarter moon to interfere with that some, but still, if you can get to a dark site and stare at the clear night sky, you'll be in good shape. We move on to this week in space history. 2004, speaking of Planet Fests, we had a big one back then for two different events. One, of course, the landing of Spirit on Mars this week, 2004, but also within a day of that, the Stardust encounter with Comet Vild 2. So the sample return that later returned lots of samples from a comet. Random space fact.
That's the first time I've ever joined in. I couldn't restrain myself.
You just can't help yourself. Speaking of New Year's, Martian New Year's, though not really celebrated quite like Earth's various New Year's celebrations, would probably be viewed by scientists as the day of the beginning of northern spring. It's when the solar longitude, which I mentioned last week, used to discuss seasons on Mars and called L sub S, is taken as the 0 degrees point. So the year is measured from that, so I'm going to declare that Martian New Year.
So Happy New Year, then, to the Martians and to us, and let's go right on into the trivia contest.
I'll let you know when Martian New Year next occurs. We move on to trivia, and I asked you, investigators from what country provided Curiosity's Rover Environmental Monitoring Station, or REMS, a weather station-type set of instruments? How'd we do, Matt?
Quite well, in spite of this being the holiday period when usually entries go way down. Peter McKenna is our winner this week. Didn't give us his address, but he's in the 616 area, if that's any help. Peter said that REMS was contributed by the Spanish government, by Spain.
It was. And then I kind of hadn't thought about it, but I know some of our contributors pointed out there were also contributions to it from Finland.
Yes.
As well. But the primary contribution of the instrument was from Spain, the lead investigators in Spain.
I do want to mention that Mark Wilson in San Diego mentioned that the Spanish contribution known as Penelope Cruz, he actually feels is a far superior package. And
now, I don't want her to take this wrong, but there would have been serious mass issues with flying her.
I suppose so.
Nothing to do with her, just the fact that, you know, she's a human.
Yeah. One more that I'll mention. Ilya Schwartz, who sent quite a detailed description of the REMS instrument, and mentioned that one of the wind speed monitors, or meters, it has two, fortunately, one of these was broken, possibly by a rock that was picked up on descent, or, I believe, thrown by a Martian.
What is that thing? Hey, you kids, get away from my spacecraft.
So anyway, we're going to send Peter one of those terrific 2013 Year in Space calendars, wall calendars. They're beautiful. And let's do one more of those for the winner, the person who correctly answers this next question from Bruce.
Hey, Earthling, can we have our ball back?
Get away, you little green kids. You bother me.
Sorry. Okay, moving to our trivia question. Who was planned to be the third person to have an extravehicular activity, EVA, or spacewalk in space? After Alexei Leonov, who had the first, Ed White had the second. Who was planned to have the third, and why did he not do it? Go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter.
What an interesting way to put that. You have until the 7th. That would be Monday, January 7, at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us this particular answer.
Okay, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about what resolutions you really might as well not make, because you're not going to keep them anyway. Thank you, and good night.
I resolve to continue to have a great time doing What's Up with Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, throughout 2013. Happy New Year, guy.
Thank you. I'll go for that one, too. Happy New Year.
That's it for this week and for 2012. What a year. I've never had more fun, learned more, or talked with a greater group of scientists, engineers, and space visionaries. I'm so grateful to everyone who made time to talk with us. The outlook for 2013 is just as bright. For example, in 2 weeks we'll take you to the meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Long Beach, California. Whether you're new to our show or a planetary radio veteran, I'm also very grateful to you for joining Emily, Bill, Bruce, and me on this journey of discovery. I hope you'll stay with us throughout the year and that your own voyage of discovery takes you wherever you hope to go. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies, everyone.
The following is an encore presentation of Sierra Club Radio.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, Steve Hawk and Amy Vitale will talk with us about a new photo series in Sierra Magazine that shows the true impacts of coal pollution on real communities. The series is called The Cost of Coal. We'll also talk with author Wendy Pabick about her new book, Taking on Water, how one water expert challenged her inner hypocrite, reduced her water footprint without sacrificing a toasty shower, and found nirvana. Joining us now is Steve Hawk, the executive editor of Sierra Magazine, and Amy Vitale, who's a photographer working on a new project that the Sierra Magazine has commissioned. We're thrilled to have them both with us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I guess I'll start by just asking Amy to tell us a little bit more about your background, because this is the first time that you, as a professional photographer, have worked with Sierra Magazine. Tell us a little bit about the kind of photography that you do, and then we'll talk about the project that you both have been working on that's so interesting.
So in the past, I began covering
really humanitarian issues, conflicts, and just various issues. And then most recently, I've started to get into environmental issues and focusing on how climate change is impacting people, especially women around the planet. So when Sierra Club called, I was thrilled. I did not know a lot about this issue until we got started.
And Steve, the issue in particular that this piece is focusing on, it's in the new issue of Sierra Magazine. And the article is called The Cost of Coal. And it's a photo series kind of unlike anything that you guys have ever done before.
Definitely unlike anything we've ever done. Much more ambitious than anything we've ever done. Largely because we were able to hire someone like Amy to shoot it. It's first and foremost a photographic essay about the human cost of dirty energy. So that was my idea from the beginning, was to kind of steer away from what the Sierra Magazine so often does, which is talk about these things from sort of 30,000 feet and talk about the issues and why it's necessary to close coal plants and parts per million and the atmosphere and all that, and really get down to the heart of it, and how coal in particular, the dirtiest of dirty energies, really has affected the lives of people all around the country. So we had the great good fortune to be able to go to Appalachia and Detroit and a Native American reservation in Nevada and talk to people who have been deeply affected by coal. And then Amy shot these beautiful photographs that are really the centerpiece of the thing. And that's it was all about the photos. So hard to talk about a little bit on radio, but we got really lucky in... She's one of the best photojournalists around, so... Amy, I'm sorry. I know you don't like it when I do this, but...
Thank you. No, thank you. And I hope that the images do exactly what covering the story did to me, which is I had read so much about coal and the cost of coal and mountaintop removal, but until you see it, it's the human stories, and until you meet those people and see those people, you know, I had never been really impacted to change much about my life, my lifestyle. And it's pretty coincidental because the solar panel guys, I had four guys on my roof today and yesterday installing solar panels. And meeting these people, these amazing people that we, that really touched both of our lives, made me come home and you know, I want to make a difference in my own life. And that's what this story did.
So tell us about some of these extraordinary stories, the people who you met, who you're able to kind of capture their lives and their personalities and their experiences in these photographs.
It felt to me like everywhere we went, there was one particular person or family who we were most drawn to and affected by.
And actually, before you talk about who they were, I mean, I'm curious, why did you choose the places that you mentioned, Appalachia, Detroit, and Nevada?
So the idea was to show how coal affects people in the whole life cycle of getting it from the out of the earth into creating energy. So we went to Appalachia to talk to people who've been affected by mountaintop removal mining. We went to Detroit to interview families who sit just downwind from a coal-fired power plant in a community where an alarming number of children have regular asthma attacks. And then we went to Nevada to interview people who sit just downwind from the coal ash dump site of a power plant, and the waste, which is just about as toxic as it gets, with selenium and lead and arsenic, blows into this community, and there's a really alarmingly high percentage of residents there who have all kinds of different diseases.
If you could paint some of the pictures for us, the images that you were able to capture, I mean, what types of things do you shoot when you're trying to show how coal is impacting people's lives in these places?
I did shoot some aerials and shot things from far, you know, far above, but it's really about getting close to people. And that's what always moves me the most. So I met some really impassioned people. They were just normal people like me, like just regular people whose lives were being impacted.
Specifically, the first thing we did was we went to Appalachia, and it just by pure coincidence, it turned out that there were a group of women who were staging a protest on the steps of the state capitol building in Charleston, West Virginia, where they were going to shave their heads to protest mountaintop removal mining. And Amy, to her credit, heard about this and said, well, I'm going to leave a day earlier than planned. I want to get there. I want to meet the woman who's organizing it at her house the day before. And it turned out this woman was having like a little sleepover with some of the other women, kind of to get unified. And Amy slept on her couch and interviewed all these women in advance, got these very powerful interviews in which these women, you know, sitting at this kitchen table, discussed why they were doing this thing, which was a big deal for all of them. You know, they all had, not by coincidence, I guess, had really beautiful hair, and they were going to be bald the next day, and they were kind of freaked out about it. And then I got there in time, and we both were at the Capitol when the event happened, and she's got some really powerful shots of people getting their heads shaved and very emotional about it.
Well said. I mean, I think that's the thing I left with was this isn't something you can, you know, we can all just sit on our couches and say, oh, that's a terrible thing. I mean, we can all do something. We can all make changes in our lives. And these women were so articulate, and they were just normal people that were moved to take action. And it seems so hopeless, but they're all fighting their battles in different ways.
Now, you also went to spend some time on a Native American reservation with the Moapa Band of Paiutes in Nevada. What was that experience like? What were some of the people like who you met there?
It was a pretty distressing story. You know, there's 200 people, 250 people living right next to this giant power plant. Opened in 1965. So the coal ash has been blowing into this community for 50 years. And not everyone, but so many of the people there just kind of seemed defeated by it and resigned to it. You know, we had one woman say something like, 50 is a miracle around here. No one makes it to the age of 50. Another guy took us on a tour of the local cemetery. And, you know, the frustration for all of them is that because it's such a small community, no one has ever come in and done a real health study to confirm where it's all happening. So they believe it, and it certainly, you know, after I left, I believed it, but there's no way to prove it, or they haven't yet proved it. At the same time, we found this woman, these mothers, who are just so strong for their children, kind of refuse to let this thing destroy their lives, refuse to let it kind of permeate the atmosphere of their homes. And you just, there's in both those homes, even though this one woman had four of her five kids have asthma, she has asthma, they're all routinely on a nebulizer, they have relatives dying. There was a sense of just real joy in this household. A big part of it for Amy and me both was to make sure that we showed that there are people living and thriving despite this kind of horrendous pollution, daily pollution.
One other point is that literally every single house had somebody dying. I mean, it was shocking to see the amount of cancer, and we witnessed it so closely.
So let me ask, I mean, Amy, you've traveled all over the world shooting images of people who are just dealing with really horrific circumstances sometimes. What was it like for you to spend some time traveling around the U.S., you know, trying to do a photo story about people who are heroically taking on these issues here?
Well, this is actually one of the hardest stories I've had to do because it's a quiet story. I mean, it's not, there aren't these, you know, bombs going off and visuals that are really sensationalistic. It's really difficult to show this thing, which is slowly killing people. And it was really emotional also to know that this is in my backyard. I feel like one of the most important stories that I've worked on because it is so, we are all so intricately connected, and whether we want to believe it or not, everything we do impacts people. I mean, what we consume impacts these people. There is no such thing as clean coal. And that was a really powerful story for me to work on.
Tell us about what you found when you were in Lindytown in Appalachia.
In the fight against mountaintop removal, Lindytown is sort of well known because it was once a thriving community of 100 families. You know, there were stores and schools, and Massey Energy, which has since been bought by someone else, had this mountaintop removal mine that you can't see from Lindytown. but you can see from the air. And Amy went up, and it wasn't until I saw her photographs that I realized, even after I'd been in Lindytown, how close this mine was to the whole area. So this mine came in, and there was so much dust and so much noise and so many explosions that people basically threatened to sue, and the mining company came in and bought all these homes and then tore them down. They would tear them down within a week of buying them, because otherwise vandals would come in and steal everything out of them, and it would look like a wasteland. But one guy didn't sell, and he has since died, but his son is now there living with the mother. So it's Roger and Quinny Richmond, and there's this one piece of property with two little houses on it, and they're the last original family. And you drive out there, you drive for a few miles through past all these empty lots that are now overgrown, and you come to this piece of property where this guy lives with his mom, and it's just so quiet and kind of sad and lonely.
Because they're the only people left in Lindytown?
There are two other houses nearby that the mining company bought and kept and moved some executives into.
Mm-hmm.
But they're the last one. And this guy talked about what it was like growing up. This is where this guy grew up. You know, he showed us his...
And his town is gone.
His town is gone. He showed us the footprints in the walkway that his parents did for him when he was 1 year old. You know, this guy's now 60-something. And he's really sweet, and the mother's really sweet. She, unfortunately, has Alzheimer's, so she's not entirely present. And it just that was the place I felt like there's this collateral damage from that kind of extraction that the mining companies sure don't want the world to know about.
When you first arrive and are driving through West Virginia, you look around and say, wow, look how beautiful this place. It's so green. Everywhere is, you know, just so lush. And it wasn't until I started working there and looking around the bends and realizing only when I got up in the airplane and flying over, it's like they've masked, even from the highways, there's mountaintop removal going just beyond the bend, and they've planted all these trees to disguise it. And then when you actually see the scale, I literally started crying. I've never had that kind of reaction before. But it was so shocking to see. It's all hidden, though. It's just...
It is. It's hidden from public view unless you're in the air. 500 mountains, 1.4 million acres, and 2,000 miles of streams.
Well, hopefully what your photo series will do in Sierra Magazine is to show people the true story, not just of the actual place, but also the people who are impacted. We're almost out of time here. Is there anything else that you'd like to add for our listeners about this photo series or your experience working on it?
There's a website attached to it that has a lot of the video as well, and many more of Amy's photographs then are in the magazine, and it's thecostofcoal.org.
Amy, tell us a little bit about River Rouge, Detroit.
River Rouge, it's three of the most polluted zip codes in the United States, and that's it. And it was almost post-apocalyptic when you arrived there. It was really shocking. And again, it's the characters, though, that we met, the people we met, that they know what's going on, and hopefully this story and others like it will give voice to their fight.
Yeah, River Rouge is, as she said, it's one of the most polluted residential zip codes in America. But it's not just coal there, although the coal-fired power plant is one of the biggest presences. They're bordered by the Marathon Oil Refinery, which refines oil from the tar sands fields in Canada. There's a gigantic wastewater treatment facility, a sewage treatment plant. There's one of the biggest steel mills in that whole region, literally on all three sides of this town. And so they're getting it, the cumulative effects of all that, and they're besieged. They're besieged, and they're just not heard. Even though there was a great opportunity to be depressed, I really came away feeling hopeful, and that was all because of the people. You know, the people who live there, they're just not going to put up with it, and they're going to figure out a way to fix it.
Amy, if there were one message that you would want viewers of this photo spread to take away from it, what would you want that to be?
I would want people to realize that it's not this hopeless thing, that we can all do things in our own life to reduce consumption and think about alternative uses of energy. I think it's important to realize that there are costs, and we may not realize it, but we're paying for the cost of dirty energy in other ways. So it's just about awareness, I think.
Well, thanks so much to both of you for joining us. You've been listening to Steve Hawk, the executive editor for Sierra Magazine, and Amy Vitale, a photographer who worked on their photo series, The Cost of Coal. To see the series and to find out more about the issue, you can visit sierramagazine.com.
I think it's human nature to want to explore.
Joining us now is Wendy Pabick to talk about her new book, Taking on Water, how one water expert challenged her inner hypocrite, reduced her water footprint without sacrificing a toasty shower, and found nirvana. Welcome.
Thanks, Orly.
So what made you decide to write this book?
I have been working on water issues for the majority of my career. I have a PhD in environmental engineering and water resources, and I've worked on in-stream flows, nutrient loading, sustainable water use, and I had a pleasant surprise one day when I came home to find an irrigation water bill for 22,000 gallons in a month. So it was sort of a shocking awakening to me, and it made me realize after many months of trying to deal with it that if I, with all my training and all the attention I pay to water issues, couldn't use water sustainably in my own life, why should we expect anyone else to?
How many gallons of water does the average U.S. household use?
Well, we use about 99 gallons per person per day.
And is that for all of the household functions, like, you know, sink, shower, toilet? Does that include, as you mentioned, irrigation, like lawns, or is that a separate amount?
It does. It does. And those numbers are higher in the arid west where I live. In Idaho, the number's more like 263 gallons per person per day. Some areas of Colorado are over 200.
Because people are using that much more water on their lawns?
Correct.
Now, what do people say, what do scientists say that number could be reduced to with simple measures? I mean, obviously people are still going to shower and wash their hands, wash their dishes, but if people instituted some of these efficiency measures, what would that number be?
Well, you know, our biological need is on the order of 13 gallons per person per day.
Mm-hmm.
So, just putting in low-flow toilets could save us trillions of gallons of water a year.
So what are some of the things that you did in your household when you started exploring this?
Well, we put in low-flow toilets. I found these little adapters for our shower that allow you to shut off the flow midstream. We looked at gray water, but reusing gray water, but the regulations are fairly strict, and it would have required drilling through walls and all sorts of stuff. So instead, we just started doing sort of some very simple water collection measures. We have just a tub in the sink, so when we wash our dishes, we actually hand deliver the water outside. And so those are the things we did to reduce our direct water use.
You talked about the low-flow toilets. What's the difference in water consumption for those versus a regular toilet?
Well, of the U.S. water budget, you know, we use about 13% of it inside our homes, and fully a quarter of that goes to toilets.
And so we're using just potable, clean drinking water to flush waste, essentially.
Exactly. But low-flow toilets, I mean, I think ours went from, you know, 4 gallons a flush to 1.6 or 1.3 maybe.
And they're just as effective?
Yes.
So besides that, what were some of the other tactics that you did that were more unusual, and what surprised you out of the project?
Well, I also looked at our water footprint, so the idea that all the products and services that we all consume have embedded water in them.
Mm-hmm.
So the average U.S. consumer in all their purchases consumes about 750,000 gallons per year.
Wow.
In embedded water, primarily in food. And so
You talk about embedded water, you mean the amount of water that it takes to grow a tomato or an apple or to raise, a pound of beef.
Exactly. And so some of the things we did to reduce our water footprint, one of the more straightforward things to do is to shift away from a meat-heavy diet. But because my husband and I don't consume a lot of meat, that wasn't much of an option. So instead, I did things like reduced our electricity use by using power strips, insulating. We got an energy audit done, insulating our water heater, because electricity has an embedded water footprint. So we reduced our electricity. We focused on...
Talk to us a little bit more about the electricity part of it. I think people sometimes don't think of electricity as using water. Tell us more about how that works.
Well, so electricity requires water for production. So, and on average, the numbers vary. Some estimates I've seen suggest it's about 25 gallons of water per kilowatt hour produced. So when I actually evaluated our annual water footprint, fully a quarter of it was via our electricity use.
How can people figure out their water footprint? It's easy to figure out your water bill in your house, but if you wanted to know about some of these bigger picture things like the food you're eating and the electricity you're using, is there a simple way to calculate that?
Well, there are water footprint calculators available online. National Geographic has one. The Water Footprint Network has one. And there's a couple of resources where you can actually look up byproduct calculated water footprints. And oftentimes it requires converting units to get the right units. But, yeah, you can go through and sort of estimate your consumption of various products and goods and commodities and using these calculators estimate your water footprint.
Now, the subtitle of your book talks about doing all these things, quote, without sacrificing a toasty shower. Do you find that sometimes people don't explore these options because they think that they're going to have to give up the comforts of life or that it's going to be hard to do it? And in your experience, were you able to make all these changes without feeling like it was much of a sacrifice?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the key is to really do the analysis to understand where in your life you're using the most water, because this whole idea of a water footprint, most people are not aware that we have, that our larger footprint is much bigger than our direct consumption in our homes for the most part. And so, for instance, food waste is a big one. There was a study in the UK that suggested that all the food, the water embedded in all the food in the country in a year exceeds the direct water consumption in people's homes by a third. So you reduce your, you know, your food waste and you're reducing the embedded water that you're consuming.
What do you think it's going to take for people to wake up to water waste as an important issue, to start caring about it more? Our bills are so cheap for it that there doesn't seem to be much of an economic incentive right now for people to make these changes.
Right. Well, that's one change that could be made. I mean, we are clearly not incorporating the full cost of water into our pricing structures. So, you know, we pollute water and or you know, with estrogen-mimicking compounds and pharmaceuticals and personal hygiene products when we dispose of wastewater into our rivers. And these compounds are ending up in our drinking water. And yet, you know, we're not, no one's being fully, held fully accountable. And so if you started to incorporate the true cost of keeping a clean drinking supply, our prices would go up. And that would surely have some effect on people's behavior. And we see that. We see when prices, you know, their appropriate pricing structures, demand goes down.
When you told people about the project that you were working on, what kind of reactions did you get?
People are really interested. People are, you know, the whole concept of a water footprint is new to a lot of people. And I think another interesting thing about my story is that of those people that are interested and concerned, we all sort of have this inner turmoil about knowing that we're trying to live more lightly on the planet, and yet it's difficult. It requires some tough choices sometimes, or at least being cognizant.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
I would just add that it's really about paying attention and trying to be the change you want to see in the world.
Is there a website for the book?
Yeah, my personal website is waterdeva.com.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Wendy Papik talk about her book, Taking on Water. And for more information, you can visit her website at waterdeva.com.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
You are now listening to WHFR, 89.3 FM on your radio dial. I am the Diva, and my show, Lyrical Infusion, is on every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Join me as I serve up some mental musical gumbo for your moody Monday pleasure. You can always listen live to WHFR at www.whfr.fm 24/7, where we're making waves. It all starts with a ripple.